أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا والشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم وأهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ومن يتق الله يجعل له مخرجا. صدق الله العلي العظيم. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. First of all, let me send my condolences to all of you on the wafat of Bibi Khadija salamullah alayha. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjal farajahum. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give us that tawfiq to apply the many lessons that she left behind for us. It's sad to me that we only have one day out of the year where we remember her and what she did for Islam. We've been talking about the idea of using worship as an outlet for our situation, and you know, there may not have, you know, she is one of the better examples we have of this reality. Before that, however, I want all of you to understand, you know, the greatness of this woman. Let's kind of spell out some of the more obvious principles and lessons we can from her life. First of all, she comes from a very, very pure lineage. Okay, her father Khuwaylid was a man who was right there beside Abdul Muttalib in looking after the Kaaba before Islam. As you know, Abdul Muttalib was the quote-unquote caretaker of the Kaaba. He had the keys. He would look after it. He would defend it. He would ensure its protection. And beside him in doing this was Khuwaylid, the father of Bibi Khadija. You know, the very famous statement in the story, of the Ashabi Fil, when Abraha had this plan now to destroy the Kaaba with his elephants. And Abdul Muttalib now had approached Abraha and asking for his stuff back. Meaning, Abraha thought that Abdul Muttalib was coming to persuade him to not attack the Kaaba. He came saying, look, you stole some of my stuff. I want that stuff back. Doesn't even mention his planned attack on the Kaaba. When Abraha says, aren't you, like, I thought you'd come here and ask me to stop and try to defend the Kaaba. And his statement to Abdul Muttalib was a beautiful one. He said, look, everyone has a house. And the owner of that house defends that house like no one else does. The Kaaba has its own owner, and that owner will protect that house. That level of certainty, yaqeen, I like to believe, also trickled down to Khuwaylid, the father of Bibi Khadija. The uncle of Bibi Khadija, Walqa ibn Nawfil. It's unfortunate that the only time that we've heard that name is in a very negative connotation. That, you know, inside of some of our Islamic books, we have this notion that when the Prophet came down after the first revelation of the Quran, he was, you know, perplexed, he was confused, he was... he didn't know what was going on. And the version we have in some books tells us that he had no idea who Jibreel was and what that whole exchange was about. So Bibi Khadija took him to her uncle, Walqa ibn Nawfil. Very spiritual man. Christian now, some books say. And he was the one that told the Prophet that you now fit all the attributes of the last Prophet of God. We as Shias, of course, reject that. But that's the only instance we have of this man named Walqa ibn Nawfil. The reality is that he was a very noble man, doing his best to spread that nobility inside of Mecca. He would stand at the gate of the cemeteries, begging the fathers, please don't bury your daughters alive. Not everyone did it. A few tribes did it, but it was a social norm back then because everybody was quiet. It was just accepted. Nobody would really speak out against it. He was one of them. You know, the fathers saw the girls, a daughter, as a liability, right? Boys can go to war, boys can work, boys can earn money, defend the tribe. Women can't do any of that. So they saw girls and daughters as, like I said before, a liability. So, you know, they would bury them because to them, all they are an added expense. So Waraq ibn Awf would actually offer these fathers money. If it's about money, I'll give you money. Just don't bother, don't bury this newborn daughter of yours alive. You know, she comes from a very pure bloodline. As you know, she meets the Prophet of Allah in terms of their family tree, five generations up. So this is no ordinary woman. On top of that, you know, we hear these things every single year, but we kind of, in one year, out the other. Do you understand how difficult it must have been for a woman to be a successful business owner during that time, peak ignorance, peak in terms of men being misogynist, this anti-woman, women were seen as commodities. If you conquered an army, there were spoils of war. You would take the sword, the shield, the animals, and the women. They were grouped all in one. In that environment, for her, pre-Islam now, for her to be successful in her business, I can only imagine the comments. I can only imagine the rudeness. I can only imagine the resistance she must have felt from men. It didn't jade her heart. It didn't harden her heart. It didn't move her away from humanity. It didn't, no. On top of that, her judge of character, her ability now to hire the Holy Prophet. He didn't have much experience. He didn't come from an affluent background. But she liked his character. She was drawn towards his character. Even when she attempted to now give him a bonus for what he was doing, he refused, right? I want to get paid according to what our agreement was. Now, all of this now, you know, you end up, when you work with someone, when you travel with someone, you end up seeing their reality. She saw the reality of the Holy Prophet, and of course, to the point where she wanted to now spend the rest of her life with him. And that brings me to point number three, her criteria for a spouse. I mean, she had a lineup at her door of the richest and the richest and the richest of Mecca. The most affluent families you could think of all wanted her hand in marriage. And she said, not everybody. And she married a shepherd, a simple individual coming from a simple background. How much ridicule she must have taken, how much pressure from her own family possibly, how much of the rumors and the backbiting and the God knows what else. How, you know, she must have been the talk of the town in the most negative way, but she powered through all that. And then on top of all of that, her inability and her staunch refusal to attach herself to her wealth. She achieved to the point where she was Malikatul Arab. I mean, she was revered in the business world. But it's unfortunate that all we ever think about is her money. And no doubt, you know, her refusal to attach herself to her wealth ultimately gave life to the fact that she, of course, spent every dollar of hers towards Islam. And then her sacrifice, her compromise, her belief in her husband's mission, not because it's her husband's mission, but because it's the right mission. When no one else was there, she was there. She would bring him in, comfort him, make him forget about everything. She would actually use the worship of God as not only an outlet for herself, but an outlet for him as well. To the point where when she passes away, 1 year the Prophet grieved, Amul Huzn, the year of grief. He would talk about her with other wives and they wouldn't like it. And if they ever made a face or said something negative about Bibi Khadija, he would say, don't you dare say a word about her. She was there when nobody was there for me. This is a special woman that Islam owes a lot to. It's not just about signing a blank check. She had the noble traits and characteristics. And, you know, as much as I don't like to, you know, narrow this talk to just our sisters, sometimes, you know, in this search for role models and this search for emulation in this world, you know, following this person on Instagram and following that person and, you know, this and that, sometimes we need to look at these personalities to be our role model. She never let her gender stop her from achieving what she could achieve in this world. She never allowed the difficulty of being the target of some disgusting men to stop her from doing what she had to do. She never allowed, you know, the money or the fame or the fortune now to taint or to stain or to, you know, to play with her criteria for marriage. She wanted to marry a noble man, a man of character, not a man of money. These are all extremely beautiful lessons for you and I to adopt. And I think the biggest lesson for her that we can extract from her, sorry, that we can extract is the idea that she was somehow unable to convince her nafs to attach herself to her wealth. Why do I say that? Because the one thing of many, now there are many things, one thing of many that got the Muslims through the last few years in Mecca, in the valley of Abu Talib, when they were banished from Mecca and sanctions were set on them, was the wealth of Bibi Khadija. They were in a valley, in a place that was scarce, no resources. They barely got, you know, enough food and water. But this idea of attachment and achievement, it was, to me, it's one of the most incredible stories. Because the Quran speaks about Qarun, right? Qarun during Nabi Musa's time. This is a person who was also the family of Nabi Musa. He also had, you know, somewhat of a pure lineage in terms of the fact that he had, you know, he had purity in his blood of Nabi Musa and Nabi Harun. And the Quran refers to his wealth being to the point where he had people that would carry the keys to his treasures. Forget his treasures alone. There's a lot of wealth. But that wealth did what? That wealth infiltrated his nafs. He sold his soul out to the point where now, of course, he even tried to sell Nabi Musa out. His ultimate demise was what? That he was swallowed by the ground. The same ground that he would walk on with pride is the same ground that showed him its power. And on one side now, you have Bibi Khadija. Not allowing her nafs to attach herself to the dunya, to this wealth. And it's a point I always make, and one that I think has to be reminded to myself and to all of you. Islam promotes the idea of achievement, especially, you know, and for our sisters too. Educated sisters. A lot of my sisters, when I talk to them, it breaks my heart that, you know, Milana, what's the point of me getting educated if I'm just going to get married and raise kids? I don't want to work in the corporate world. And that's fine. That's your decision. It's okay. But it doesn't mean you don't get educated. It doesn't mean that you don't achieve something in your life. If not for any other reason than because when a smart, intelligent, academic mother raises children, she raises those kids with the same values that she has herself. So my sisters and my brothers, in light of this theme that we're talking about for the past three nights now, of worship being an outlet, the tiniest of steps, the smallest of movements, you know, Bibi Khadija was one who embraced the gradual, you know, application and implementation of the deen. It's sad that she never saw the glory days of Medina. It was those years in Shibu Abu Talib, the valley of Abu Talib, that ultimately got her sick and she left this world before the migration to Medina. But she saw that slowly but surely now, with consistency, her husband now would build a support system around them. And they threw everything at him. They asked him, do you want fame? Do you want fortune? Do you want women? Do you want power? What do you want? They would beg Abu Talib, go tell your nephew to stop preaching these things. It's affecting our worship, our business, everything. And that's when the Prophet says very famously, you know, they place the sun and the moon in my hands. Even then, I will not give up my mission. The one beside him in that, gradually but surely now, using worship now as an outlet was Bibi Khadija. How difficult it must have been for those two. How hard must it have been for her to watch her husband go through that day in and day out. He would shiver. He would sweat. He would change colors. And she would be there putting a cloak on him, you know, drying his hair, wiping his face from the sweat, making this mahallay sukoon, this place of serenity for him, and using the worship of Allah as an outlet for all the stress. You don't think people were talking about her in Mecca? That look what you were before you married Muhammad? Look, you know, look at you now. You don't think people were talking? Of course they were. They didn't have a conscience back then. There was no sort of filter. There was no morality. There was nothing there. They were people of chaos. And you don't think for a moment that got back to her ears? How did she manage that? That's not an anxious time in her life? A stressful time in her life? Of course it is. And somehow the way the books tell us is that she drowned herself right beside the Prophet, the first person to accept Islam and stand beside the Holy Prophet with Bibi Khadija. And everything was yours. Literally, whatever you want from me. You want my support. You want my patience. You want me to stand beside you. You want the resources, whatever I have. Then by all means, go ahead. But it was the ability for her to use her worship as an outlet to get through the everyday struggle. And she passed it over to her daughter, Bibi Fatima Zahra, salamu alayha. You look at those days in Kufa post the Holy Prophet. They were very difficult days in Medina. When Imam Ali would come home and complain to his wife that, look, you know, people weren't giving jawab to my salam. They weren't replying to me. I'm greeting them. And they would turn their face and walk away. You know how hard it is when someone greets you, says salamun alaykum to you, attempts not to have a conversation, and you physically turn your face and you walk away? That's one of the biggest insults there is. He would come home not having one, but multiple experiences like that in the streets of Medina. This was the beloved Ali who would feed the poor and look after the orphans and look after the widows and save the Muslims from the enemies with his sword, only to have a handful supporting him. And who was there when he got home? His wife. Who was the one now standing in the middle of the night to the point where her feet would swell from worship, all as an outlet? Bibi Fatima. Where is that tarbiyah coming from? Bibi Khadija. There's too many lessons. We should have an ashra for Bibi Khadija. I tell you, one 10-day series on how this woman was able to do what she did at a time where it was unheard of. Even today, some female CEOs are looked down upon. You know, this whole pay scale debate in sports and other areas, it still exists today. Imagine now in this enlightened era, how it was back then in the Jahiliyyah era. It must have been tenfold. She was able to use her worship. And that worship did something very important to her. Part of the outlet of the worship was the ability now for her to separate herself from the dunya. There are those people who live in this world. And Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, Allama Majlisi, rahmatullah alayh, both of them have a very beautiful discussion on the dunya and the akhirat. In his 40 hadith book, I believe in hadith number 25, the love of this world, if my memory serves me. He talks about defining this dunya, defining this world, defining this hereafter. One point that I have to repeat constantly wherever I go, and there still continues to be a misconception, and I'm going to use this wafat to clear up that misconception, and that is this idea that, you know, Islam does not equate poverty to piety. Islam does not say in order for you to be a person of God, you have to live in a certain size home, or wear certain ripped up clothing, or drive a clunker of a car, or have all the visible marks and the visible signs of someone who is poor, quote, or struggling, or hand-to-mouth. If you are a little bit affluent and a little bit comfortable in your finances, where you don't have to worry about your payments, then Islam says, yeah, you're not very pious. That, I think, has been a misconception for many of our youth for many, many years, just based on my experience with my questions. And this is that lady that told us, look, achievement and attachment are two separate phenomena inside of Islam. Islam says, achieve, man. Achieve. But don't attach. How do I know? What does attachment mean? Placing a value on what you achieve higher than it has. Three brothers, two brothers, five siblings, six siblings, as tight as siblings can be all throughout their life. Best friends. Mom and dad pass away, and they're fighting each other in court for a couple of extra zeros and maybe a thousand or two. That's placing a higher value on that cash than it deserves. That's allowing attachment to occur. So the dunya is not a physical world. In this hadith I talk about, Alama Majlisi Rahmatullah Alayh, he says that the dunya is a way of life, is a philosophy of life. He says those collective elements that actually pull us towards the dhikr and remembrance of God are the akhirat. And those collective elements that pull us away from the dhikr of Allah is the dunya. It's not confined to a single world. There are those who live in this dunya, but they're ukhrawi in nature. They're actually in the hereafter. Imam Ali approaches Salman in Farsi one day, says, Salman, do you want to see yourself right now in heaven? I will show you with my hand a picture of you lying in heaven. And he shows him. It looks beautiful. It looks so amazing. Do you want to go there now? You have that freedom. Meaning what? Salman is in this dunya, living in this world. But Ali is able to show him a glimpse of him in that world. That's a man who, while being in this world, quote unquote, is actually ukhrawi in nature. It is actually the ahl akhirat in nature. Then there are those who are in that akhirat and yet they are still stuck in the dunya. They still think that all the mal that I collected, that's going to be my salvation. They think that, you know what, I can't wait to be the richest man in the qabristan, in the cemetery. Nobody wants to be the richest person in the cemetery. Nobody cares how rich you were in the cemetery. Du'a Ahad is a beautiful du'a that we recite every day as a renewal of the bay'at and allegiance of Imam Zaman. In there is a beautiful line. In that section where we talk about, if death befalls upon me, if I die before the zuhur of the imam, the dua says what? فَأَخْرِجْنِي مِنْ قَبْرِي. Pull me out of my grave. Such that, you know, my kafan is my libas, I have my sword and my shield in my hand, symbolic to what? To defend the imam. This is a person who left this world, who's in that world. But, you know, he was very much a person who was part of the akhirah. Even though he left this world, he's brought back to serve in this world. My point is that dunya and akhirah are not physical worlds. It's not like planet Earth is dunya and some invisible metaphysical realm is the akhirah. No, not at all. Not like that. It's a way of life. It's elements inside of this dunya, of this temporal world that can either pull us from God or away from God. The same Imam Ali Nahjul Balagha praises the dunya, but as the bridge, not as a destination. The bridge has its importance, but not as the destination. Imam Radha says that this dunya, this world is a bridge, and you don't build homes on bridges. Achieve in this world. But don't attach yourself to that world. When you use worship as an outlet, you train the heart to achieve through dua, achieve through worship. But that worship now avoids the nafs from attaching itself to what you have. Such that when it's time for you to go, you spend 60, 65, 70 years building this castle in this dunya. When it's time to go, you give the keys and you walk away. Imam Ali says, the car that you love so much is now being driven by somebody else. The house that you built is now being lived in by somebody else. The spouse that you loved is now married to somebody else. You walked away. Her life was the manifestation of our topic for the past 3 nights. We have to give this woman her respect. To the point now where, like I said, the devastating last few days of her life. She was so generous and gave so much to the Holy Prophet that even in her last few days, the books say that there wasn't a coffin for her to wrap her body in. She was very close to the Holy Prophet. It must have been so devastating. A kafan was brought when Bibi Khadija left this world. She became ill as Shibi Abu Talib and passed away. And a kafan was brought, and some say the kafan was a little bit short, so the Prophet of Allah would take his abba off his shoulders and wrap the rest of her body in that abba. He was so adamant that, "I want my Khadija's body to be wrapped properly. I want her buried properly. I want the kafan to cover her from head to toe. It doesn't matter if it's one kafan from somewhere or my abba from another." But she was adamant about covering the body. "I don't want her to be buried without a kafan. I don't want her to be kafan." And I would say this to you, Ya Rasulullah, you were so adamant about Bibi Khadija having a kafan. You used your own abba to wrap the other portion of her body. If only you were there in Karbala, Ya Rasulullah, maybe your abba could have covered your grandson Hussein. When there came a moment now, on the 2nd of Muharram, I find this very ajeeb. Every year I read this masaib, and I find it very, very ajeeb that on the 2nd of Muharram, he arrives in Karbala, understands this place is called Karbala. He summons the men of the Bani Asad tribe. He says, "Look, there's going to be a war here. We're going to be killed here. If you can, each and every one of you, bury us men one by one if you can." And then he puts up a partition and he talks to the women of the Bani Asad tribe. "If your men are not able to bury us, then all of you collectively just dig one massive grave and place our bodies inside that grave." He then went so far to go to the small, masoom children of the Bani Asad tribe. He picked one up. He hugged them. He kissed him. "Are you Muslim?" "Yes, I am." Do you recite the kalama?" "Yes, I do." "This Muhammad Rasulullah that you recite is my grandfather. I am Hussein, the son of Fatima. There's going to be a battle here, a war here. If your parents aren't able to bury us, all of you just pick up the khak of Karbala with your small masoom hands. Drop it on our bodies." Why, Mola? Why the need to go to the men, the women, the kids? "Bury us. Bury us, bury us." Nobody does that. When someone passes away in our community, immediately now they are, all of the intizam and all of the arrangements are made for their funeral, their burial, their kafan, and their salat, and their talqeen. No one needs to call the group and say, "Can you please bury my father? Please bury my mother." It's already taken care of. It's known. But Imam Hussein felt the need to go to 3 different groups of people to please make sure that we're buried. Maybe he knew that he'd be left on the ground of Karbala for 3 days on the burning sand, beheaded and trampled without even a kafan on his body. Maybe he knew that not only will they kill me, but they'll disrespect my body. Umar ibn Sa'd says, "I want 10 horses, 5 on the right of Hussein, 5 from the left of Hussein, on my command now. The ones from the right go to the left, the ones from the left go to the right. The khak of Karbala is in the air. Hussein's body is underneath. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to accept this qaleel ibadat, inshallah. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to give us that tawfiq, inshallah, to learn the lessons from this great lady. We ask you, Allah, accept our aman, forgive our sins, and give us that tawfiq to benefit from this month, inshallah. Matamir Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein.